Before the break, we heard a song by Libby Roderick, "The Body is the Temple." We now hear another by her called Rosa.
Rosa! Rosa called me, she said, "Don't you take the back of no bus. Every woman here deserves respect. Ain't nothing too good for us, sweet women. Nothing too good for us." And Nikki Giovanni, she tell it like it is. She say, "Ooh, when you're black like me, you are queen of the world. Ain't nothing too rich for you, sweet women. Nothing too rich for you."
Now for some announcements. Tomorrow, Sunday, March 13th, Dennis Kucinich, sponsor of the bill to create the Department of Peace, will be in Amesbury, Mass., speaking at Unity Church. At 8:45 a.m. and 11 a.m., he'll be talking at their services. He will then have an open meeting from 1 to 3 p.m. For directions to the event, see www.propeace.net. You can also contact Christina at christt tinakr58@comcast.net for more info. On Monday, March 14th at 1 p.m., the New Hampshire State Legislature will be discussing a Patriot Act resolution in Concord at the State House in Concord. That evening, there is actually a change. The Portsmouth City Council work session on the proposed resolution to support the U.S. Bill of Rights has been moved from March 14th to March 28th. It will still be at 6:30 p.m. in the City Hall, and we'll continue to remind you about it as it nears. On Wednesday, March 16th at 7 p.m., the second of a multimedia series, Creating a Peaceful World, The Challenge of Oil, will be happening. It's sponsored by the Dover Friends Meeting, Peace and Social Concerns Committee, Seacoast Peace Response, and the Alliance for Democracy. The topic that night will be a discussion of Crossing the Rubicon, The Decline of the American Empire at the End of the Age of Oil by Mike Rupert, Chapters 1 and 2. It will be held at the Dover Friends Meeting House, 141 Central Ave in Dover. For more info, contact 603-431-8644. Also on Wednesday, March 16th at 7 p.m., if you're in the Laconia area, Arlington West will be shown. The film consists of 64 candid interviews with U.S. soldiers and Marines coming from and going to Iraq, and American military families who have lost a family member in Iraq. The film will be shown in the community room at the Laconia Police Station. It's free and refreshments will be served. For more info, call 528-8560. Next weekend, March 19th and 20th, will mark the second anniversary of the U.S. invasion of Iraq. To commemorate that event, a number of activities will be held. The first will be on Friday night, March 18th, a banner-making party at an art studio in Kittery, Maine. For information about that, contact Jamila at jamilla@wellinformed.org. On Saturday, March 19th, from 12 noon to 1 p.m., there will be a vigil for peace in solidarity with the march in Washington, D.C. That will be happening in Newburyport, Mass., in their Market Square. For more info, contact Barbara at barbara.hildt@verizon.net. Also on Saturday, March 19th, from 10 a.m. to 1:30 p.m., there will be a Concord High School teach-in. This program is intended for high school and college students only. The focus will be on nonviolent action and counter-recruitment. Contact Nikki at the AFSC, 603-224-2407. Following that, there will be a mass convergence on the Concord, New Hampshire State House Plaza at 2 p.m. The theme is Oppose War and Occupation. Speak, sing, and dance against war and occupation with people from around the state in a youth-led demo at the State House in Concord. Come join artists, musicians, and activists in resisting war. Bring your signs and banners. For more information on that, also contact Nikki at 224-2407. The following day, Sunday, March 20th, local progressive and radical peace groups have made a call for actions in the Seacoast area and are going to be calling a gathering in Market Square at 2 p.m. Please join folks for in a space to express the outrage so many feel. The aim is to create a place where people can vigil, play music, make art, drum, etc. This is sponsored by Seacoast Peace Response and the New Hampshire Anti-Fascists. For more info, you can call 750-7506. That evening, Seacoast Peace Response is planning to show a double feature of movies. WMD, Weapons of Mass Deception, followed by The Revolution Will Not Be Televised. Exact time and location is to be announced. The following week, we'll just give you another reminder of the postponed from March 1st events. Frida Berrigan will be coming that afternoon, 12:30 at UNH. She will discuss women in war. And that evening, 7 p.m. in Portsmouth at the UU Church, she will discuss war profiteering in Iraq. Both events are free and open to the public. And you can contact 750-7506 or amyla44@juno.com for more info. This past week marked some anniversaries to be noted. On March 8th, International Women's Day happened. The following day, March 9th, 1994, was when the first UN resolution against anti-Semitism by the Human Rights Commission was passed. And the day after that, March 10th, 1989, the Human Rights Commission recognized the right to refuse military service as a human right. There's another very upsetting anniversary that is coming up this week. On March 16th, 2003, United States activist Rachel Corrie was killed doing accompaniment work in Palestine, attempting to stop the bulldozing of a home that was being targeted by Israeli defense forces. She was killed during that action, and we share this song with you by David Rovix called The Death of Rachel Corrie.
She sat down in the dirt in front of your machine, a lovely woman dressed in red, you in military green. If you had met her in Jerusalem, you might have asked her on a date. But here you were in Gaza, rolling towards the gate. As your foot went to the floor, you recall her eyes? Did her gaze remind you that you've become what you despise? As you rolled on towards this woman and ignored all shouts to stop, did you feel a shred of doubt as you watched her body drop? As your caterpillar tracks upon her body pressed with 60 tons of deadly force, crushed the bones within her chest, could you feel the contours of her face as you took her life away? Did you serve your country well on that cool spring day? Just another day in a dirty war. When you looked out on the water, did you feel an empty void? Or was it just one more life you've taken, one more home destroyed, one more home destroyed?
On March 4, 2005, Lloyd Axworthy, president of the University of Winnipeg and a former Canadian foreign minister, wrote in the Winnipeg Free Press an open letter to Condoleezza Rice. It goes something like this. Dear Condi, I'm glad you've decided to get over your fit of pique and venture north to visit your closest neighbor. It's a chance to learn a thing or two, maybe more. I know it seems improbable to your divinely guided master in the White House that mere mortals might disagree with participating in a missile defense system that has failed in its last three tests, even though the tests themselves were carefully rigged to show results. But gosh, we folks above the 49th parallel are somewhat cautious types who can't quite see laying down billions of dollars in a three-dud poker game. As our erstwhile prairie-born and bred, and therefore prudent, finance minister pointed out in presenting his recent budget, we've had 8 years of balanced or surplus financial accounts. If we're going to spend money, Mr. Goodall added, it will be on daycare and health programs, and even on more foreign aid and improved defense. Sure, that doesn't match the gargantuan multi-billion dollar deficits that your government blithely runs up fighting a quote-unquote liberation war in Iraq, laying out more than half of all weapons expenditures in the world, and giving massive tax breaks to the top 1% of your population while cutting food programs for poor children. Just chalk that up to a different sense of priorities about what a national government's role should be when there isn't a prevailing mood of manifest destiny. Coming to Ottawa might also expose you to a parliamentary system that has a thing called question period every day, where those in the executive are held accountable by an opposition for their actions, and where demands for public debate on important topics, such as missile defense, can be made openly. You may also notice that it's a system in which the governing party's caucus members are not afraid to tell their leaders that their constituents don't want to follow the ideological, perhaps teleological, fantasies of Canada's continental co-inhabitant, and that this leader actually listens to such representations. Your boss did not avail himself of a similar opportunity to visit our House of Commons during his visit, fearing, it seems, that there might be some signs of dissent. He preferred to issue his diktat on missile defense in front of a highly controlled, pre-selective audience. That sounds familiar. That's the way he usually does it. Such control freak antics might work in the virtual one-party state that now prevails in Washington, but in Canada we have a residual belief that politicians should be subject to a few checks and balances, an idea that your country once espoused before the days of empire. If you want to have us consider your proposals and positions, present them in a proper way, through serious discussion, across the table in our cabinet room, as your previous president did when he visited Ottawa. And don't embarrass our Prime Minister by lobbing a verbal missile at him while he sits on a public stage with no chance to respond. Now, I understand that there may have been some miscalculations in Washington based on faulty advice from your resident governor of the Northern Territories, Ambassador Cellucci, but you should know by now that he hasn't really won the hearts and minds of most Canadians through his attempts to browbeat and command our allegiance to U.S. policies. Sadly, Mr. Cellucci has been far too closeted with exclusive groups of experts from Calgary think tanks and neocon lobbyists at cross-border conferences to remotely grasp a cross-section of Canadian attitudes, nor American ones for that matter. I invite you to expand the narrow perspectives that seem to inform your opinions of Canada by ranging far wider in your reach of contacts and discussions. You would find that what is rising in Canada is not so much anti-Americanism, as claimed by your and our right-wing commentators, but fundamental disagreements with certain policies of your government. You would see that, rather than just reacting to events by drawing on old conventional wisdoms, many Canadians are trying to think our way through some ideas that it can be helpful in building a more secure world. These Canadians believe that security can be achieved through well-modulated efforts to protect the rights of people, not just nation-states. To encourage and advance international cooperation on managing the risk of climate change, they believe that we need agreements like Kyoto. To protect people against international crimes like genocide and ethnic cleansing, they support new institutions like the International Criminal Court, which, by the way, you might strongly consider using to hold accountable those committing atrocities today in Darfur, Sudan. And these Canadians believe that the United Nations should indeed be reformed, beginning with an agreement to get rid of the veto held by major powers over humanitarian interventions to stop violence and predatory practices. On this score, you might want to explore the concept of responsibility to protect while you're in Ottawa. It's a Canadian idea born out of the recent experience of Kosovo and informed by the many horrific examples of inhumanity over the last half century. Many Canadians feel it has a lot more relevance to providing real human security in the world than missile defense ever will. This is not just some quirky notion concocted on long winter nights, by the way. It seems to have appeal for many in your country, if not the editorialists at the Wall Street Journal or Rush Limbaugh. As I discovered recently while giving a series of lectures in Southern California, there is keen interest in how the U.S. can offer real leadership in managing global challenges of disease, natural calamities, and conflict, other than by military means. There is also a very strong awareness on both sides of the border on how vital Canada is to the U.S. as a partner in North America. We supply copious amounts of oil and natural gas to your country. Our respective trade is the world's largest in volume, and we are increasingly bound together by common concerns over depletion of resources, especially very scarce fresh water. Why not discuss these issues with Canadians who understand them, and seek out ways to better cooperate in areas where we agree, and agree to respect each other's views when we disagree? Above all, ignore the Cassandras who deride the state of our relations because of one missile defense decision. Accept that, as a friend, on your border, we will offer a different, independent point of view, and that there are times when truth must speak to power. In friendship, Lloyd Axworthy.
We now bring you some facts about Social Security from the Economic Policy Institute. Social Security is not going broke. Each year, in early spring, the trustees of Social Security release their report. As required by law, the trustees present what can be described as their best guesses for three different scenarios for the future of Social Security. In their annual report for 2004, the trustees project that Social Security will take in more income than it will pay out in expenditures until 2018. Between 2018 and 2028, interest income earned on the trust fund assets is forecasted to make up the difference between income and expenditures. After 2028, Social Security is expected to draw down its trust funds to pay for the expenditures that are not covered by income. Finally, in 2042, the trust fund assets are expected to be gone and income is projected to be less than expenditures. However, the trustees project that Social Security will still be able to pay 74% of its promised benefits from 2042 to 2078, and that those benefits will still be higher in real, inflation-adjusted, terms than retirees are being paid today.
We are rising up. Rising from the depth of our despair, we are rising up, rising from the depth of our despair, we are women of the world. We're from the east, south, north, and west. We are women of the world. We're from the mountains, the valleys, the cities, and the farms. We are women of the world. We're from poverty, illiteracy, circumcision, shame. We are women of the world. We are housewives, nine-to-fives, mothers displaced. We are women of the world. And we're coming from Beijing, ready for change. We are telling our stories and sharing our lives so that never again can the truth be denied. We've untied our tongues and we're speaking out loud. We've unbound our feet and marching toward freedom. Telling our stories and sharing our lives so that never again can the truth be denied. We are rising up. Women of the world, we're from the east, south, north, and west. We are women of the world, we're from the mountains, the valleys, the cities, and the farms. We are women of the world, we're from poverty, illiteracy, circumcision, shame. We are women of the world, we are housewives, 9 to 5s, mothers, displaced. We are women of the world, and we're coming from Beijing, ready for change. Women are rising up.
That was Sweet Honey in the Rock with a soundbite from Beijing.
This is Amy Antonucci for Making Waves. I'm speaking with Jennifer Bills, former Portsmouth resident, now residing in Jamaica Plain, Massachusetts. 10 years ago, Jen participated in the United Nations 4th World Conference on Women, which was held in Beijing, China, in September 1995. Nearly 180 government delegations and 2,500 non-governmental organizations met to discuss a broad range of issues that concern women. With the theme, Action for Equality, Development, and Peace, this event has been called the largest and most influential of all the world conferences on women. Welcome, Jen, and thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you very much for having me.
Can you start by telling us how it came about that you attended the conference?
I'd be happy to. I was working for the National Abortion and Reproductive Rights Action League, NARAL, in Washington, D.C., and I was lucky enough to be among the many, many groups, non-governmental organizations, that had a chance to go and advocate with the government delegates. And so we were one of the organizations among the thousands you mentioned that were able to go to the conference and try to lobby the delegates representing the governments there.
And can you tell us more about the conference itself and maybe a little of the history of it?
Yes. Well, the first World Conference on Women was held 30 years ago in 1975 in Mexico City, Mexico. And this was the fourth World Conference on Women in 1995, held in Beijing, China. There were actually two conferences in China. There was a first conference of only NGOs that began a few days before the official governmental UN conference started. And the NGOs met together sort of, you know, to coordinate our efforts and try to increase our effectiveness in lobbying the actual government delegates, who then met for several days and ultimately agreed on a document that is called the Beijing Platform for Action. This document identified 12 critical areas of concern. So as you correctly mentioned in the beginning, it was ultimately signed by 189 governments. And there was a lot of discussion, though, that went into it, and there was a lot of disagreements. There were a lot of dissenting parties on various issues. A lot of compromises were made. But it was an incredible moment because this huge majority of the world's nations agreed with the proposition that women's status and the human rights of women are fundamental to achieving development and peace and equality throughout the world, and are not just women's issues, but issues affecting women affect the world, and improving women's status is critical to improving the lives of everyone in the world.
That's a really interesting observation. Can you say more about how women's issues are the world's issues?
Sure. Well, some of the critical areas of concern that the government identified were the economy, health care, peace and security, human and legal rights, governance and politics, the environment, spirituality and religion, science and technology, media, arts and culture, race and ethnicity, and youth. And in a society when all of the leaders in the government are men, unfortunately, often don't take into account particular concerns or problems or issues of women. And in societies where women do play a more active political role, the status of women tends to be better. For example, in certain Scandinavian countries where women represent nearly half of the elected representatives and there have been, you know, heads of state who are women, the status of women is greatly improved. And women are mothers and in many, many parts of the world are still primary caretakers of children and elderly people, often cook the food and provide health care, and they're essential to families throughout the world, and they're just essential to societies. And when women are affected by violence, then their families are affected by violence. And when women are safe, their children and their families tend to be safer. And so the amazing thing was that the governments were coming together and recognizing that, you know, when women are safer, when women are better educated, when women are more involved in politics, the whole society prospers and benefits.
That's an amazing thing for governments and the people to have come together to declare.
It was an incredible experience
to
witness.
Yeah, I wonder if you can tell more about specific memories or highlights from the conference. And how many people made it to the conference?
I think it was nearly 10,000. It was thousands and thousands of people, and not just women, I should say, but predominantly women. So many things amazed me in this experience, and it was completely life-changing. But, you know, the most meaningful, I think, were meeting women who were from, you know, rural areas and countries in Africa, in Asia, in all parts of the world who did not have a lot of resources and had managed to get themselves, you know, halfway across the world to this conference, and to hear the stories of their activism at home. I was coming to this conference concerned about women's reproductive and sexual health, primarily. That was the hat I was wearing. And, you know, there were lots of women from all over the place where, you know, abortion's illegal, where birth control is illegal, where saying no to sex with your husband is illegal, and rape isn't recognized or punished. I mean, so just on that issue alone, women overcame so many hurdles just to be at the conference and to discuss these issues. But that aside, there were also women there who were organizing around issues like access to water to irrigate the crops so that they could eat. And so many issues about the environment, about, you know, violence and about equality, about access to education. It was just amazing to me where, you know, I was coming from the United States where, albeit there's plenty of discrimination against women, you know, we enjoy an incredible status of living here, relatively, and meeting women who had been holding bake sales for 2 years to get enough money to come to the conference was really humbling and really inspiring.
What went on during their conference? Were there a lot of speeches, workshops, panels?
Yes, all of the above. In the NGO conference, it was so much fun. It was held, actually, far outside of Beijing. I can't remember exactly how far, at least half an hour to an hour outside, and so there were all these transportation problems with women getting to the conference. Like, who knows? We speculated on why they shipped us off-site, but nevertheless, the women had a great time, and it rained a lot, and we were muddy, but there were all kinds of conferences, panels, speakers. Hillary Clinton, who was First Lady at the time, addressed the conference. There were dances and art performances. There were spontaneous marches and demonstrations that took place. You know, there were panels where people from all walks of life came together and really explored their common concerns. concerns and issues, and as well as their differences. It was really phenomenal.
Sounds wonderful. It reminds me, we recently had someone on the show who had gone to the Brazilian World Social Forum last month, and sounds like very similar things happening.
I think it was very similar. I actually recently read about that forum. I was reading about particularly all the arts and cultural activities that took place, and there really were a lot of those. Sweet Honey and the Rock performed in Beijing at the NGO Forum. So many performers. Chinese dragon dancers, a troupe that was all women, performed and welcomed us. It was amazing, the talented women who were performing and spontaneous demonstrations that erupted, and it was great.
Sounds like true democracy in action.
Yes, it absolutely was.
So can you continue on and tell us something about the governmental piece of the conference?
Yes. After the activists had organized ourselves a bit and had a lot of fun, exchanged a lot of stories and information, the government conference commenced, and this is where official delegates to the UN representing different countries were meeting to hammer out language for this document that ultimately got adopted, the Beijing Platform for Action. And the NGOs, really, we were trying to lobby at that point to actually impact the words that ended up in the document, and sometimes we were included in the U.S. delegation meetings. Sometimes NGOs would just meet on their own and then issue press releases or, you know, pass out suggested changes, and occasionally got to actually sit in at the official UN session where they were hammering out, you know, take out this word, insert these words. And that was fascinating. A personal highlight for me was when the delegates were discussing sexual and reproductive rights and health issues, and the issue of sexual orientation came up. And this is, to my understanding, the first time that actual government delegates were deliberating the issue of sexual orientation and talking about discrimination against lesbians in particular. And ultimately, there was not a consensus for sexual orientation to be included in the government document, but throughout the debate, several countries got up and made very compelling arguments in support of including it and support for the rights of gays and lesbians. I mean, South Africa stands out to me as one of the countries speaking so strongly in support of it. They had recently enacted their brand new constitution, their brand new democracy, and that is included in their constitution. And they were talking about how discrimination against any group is wrong, and we know and take it from us in our history. And it was just incredibly moving, and it was disappointing that that language wasn't ultimately included in the government document. But, like I said, it was very inspiring, and it was historical that the debate happened at all. And there was good language that got in around, you know, sexual rights. Like I mentioned before, the right of a woman to say no to sex is something most of us in this country take for granted, but in many countries it's still not the norm. So that's, when I'm talking about sexual rights, that's the main part of the discussion. I mean, there also was discussion of female circumcision, which is a nice euphemism for a practice that still occurs in some parts of the world that the governments took a strong stand against at this conference.
Are there other pieces from the governmental part that you particularly remember?
Well, yes, actually. I remember a lot of contention around the issue of abortion, since that was one of the lenses through which I was viewing the conference. That was why I got to go. It was interesting to me to learn that the Holy See, which is the Vatican, which is not a country, which is located within Italy, has a full voting member at the UN. And they were very much opposed to not only abortion, but birth control and a lot of the sexual health and rights discussions that were going on. And they were allied with some of the more rogue countries like the Sudan and others. Luckily, there weren't a lot of those countries. They were very vocal and very adamant.
I had no idea that the Vatican had so much power in the UN.
Mm-hmm. They really do. And in fact, 5 years after Beijing, there was a special session of the UN General Assembly called Beijing Plus Five, where governments sort of took stock of what progress had been made and just basically reiterated their commitment to the goals. Unfortunately, not as much progress had been made as we could have hoped. And then this year, what's been going on in New York over the past week at the UN is a similar review. It's called the 10-Year Global Review, and there's not going to be probably a new document that's going to come out of this, but basically given the political situation today with the current administration in the United States, they're pretty much allied with the Holy See at this point on these issues that we've been discussing. Most NGOs and advocates are hoping that there's not a new document this year because we feel like it's going to be many steps backwards
right.
if there is a written document that comes out of it. We're basically hoping for governments to continue to follow up on the commitments that were made 10 years ago in Beijing.
That's a sad statement. That
it is.
At this point, things would be going backwards. Can you tell us more about follow-up from the conference that you particularly were part of?
Yes. Well, I came back from the conference. I'd moved to New Hampshire, actually, right after I returned from the conference, and shortly thereafter met up with a few other women from New Hampshire. There were about a dozen of us who had all gone in different capacities, some representing organizations, some completely individually, and we found each other, and we were so energized and inspired and excited that we decided to host a follow-up conference in New Hampshire the following year. So in 1996, we actually convened a conference in Concord, New Hampshire, called The Spirit of Beijing. Over 500 women from around New Hampshire attended the conference. We had workshops on health and education, on girls, on the environment, on the media, violence and economics. People came together to basically talk about follow-up to the conference and how we can bring it home. Women and some men who attended talked about how we can improve healthcare and education and political status of women in New Hampshire. It was a very exciting conference, and I think a lot of allies were made, and a lot of people went forward from that day, committed to working on projects together.
Yeah, I actually remember the conference. I went, and Arnie Alpert, the AFSC coordinator that we spoke to a couple weeks ago about his time at the World Social Forum, was giving a presentation, I remember, about sweatshops and globalization's impact on women, and that was really the first time I had thought about and begun to learn about those issues, which now are a big part of my work and focus.
That was a lot of fun, and it was inspiring to see, you know, what great things people around New Hampshire are doing for peace and for justice and equality. It was a great time, and we need to have those conferences from time to time to both connect with other activists and other people and just to re-energize ourselves, too, and to hear and to learn, too, like you said, about the impact that connections we may not even make.
Right. The whole experience of going to the conference and the follow-up you participated in, how would you say it's influenced your life and your work since that time?
I think that it greatly, although it was very humbling and awe-inspiring, it was also very empowering. And after I came back from the conference and after we did the conference in New Hampshire, about a year later I went to law school, and I had, for various reasons, been putting that off and sort of doubting whether I could do it, and I did it, and now I'm a lawyer practicing civil rights in Boston. And I have to say that I feel that the conference was a huge influence on me because I just came away feeling like, yes, more women need to be in more positions of power and be advocating, and we need to put away those doubts that we all have and just go forward and meet the challenges. And so in my personal life, I feel like I owe a lot to the women I met at the conference for encouraging me to go on and do what I want to do and one of my dreams.
That's great. That sounds like a wonderful outcome from the conference. Hopefully a lot of women were impacted that way. I would imagine so.
Yeah. I mean, it was incredible. There were some women who brought their young daughters to the conference. You know, maybe they were 9, 10 years old, and I would love to see where they are now. There was a group of young women from various different countries going around as junior reporters reporting back on the conference to their home countries.
Mm.
And there were just some incredible things, and I'm sure that the impact of the conferences, we'll never even know how big an impact it made, but it was huge.
Tell us a little more. Since leaving New Hampshire and going to law school and now actually being a practicing lawyer, tell us a little bit more about your work.
Well, I've done a few different things since law school. Right now, I'm in a small firm in Boston doing civil rights law. We represent people who experience discrimination on the job, women and men, on the basis of their gender, their race, their sexual orientation, their religion. We also represent people in police misconduct cases where they're either wrongfully arrested, they're beaten up by the police. We're trying to be a check on the state, I guess you could say, trying to enforce people's First Amendment rights, Fourth Amendment, Fifth, Sixth Amendment, basically trying to enforce people's constitutional rights. Our firm has represented some people who protested at the Democratic National Convention last year and who were harassed by the police. We are trying to stand up for individual rights wherever we can. And as I said in the beginning, in the United States, many of us have it better than many people, but there's still abuses that happen here, and there's still abuses of power, and we're trying to be somewhat of a check on that. We also had a huge class action suit where we represented women in the Boston area who had been illegally strip searched after being arrested. One woman was arrested for selling sausages on the street with her license expired. She hadn't renewed her license to sell sausages, and she was arrested. And at that time, the Suffolk County House of Correction had a blanket policy to strip search all women, but not men.
Hmm.
So our firm sued on behalf of all women and got that policy changed, and also got some compensation for the women whose rights had been violated.
Good for you. At the moment, some groups in the Seacoast have put forth a resolution that affirms the Bill of Rights and speaks out against the USA Patriot Act, which impinges on a lot of those rights, such as the First Amendment rights. And that resolution is in front of the Portsmouth City Council right now.
Wow.
So this is a really important and really interesting time to be doing that work, I'm sure.
It is a very interesting time, and there's a lot that needs to be done. We need more lawyers, frankly, doing this kind of work, in my opinion.
Right. Well, Jen, thanks so much for talking to us. It was wonderful to get your perspective on the conference.
Well, thank you, Amy. I'm really glad you're doing the show. It was a phenomenal experience. I was privileged to attend, and I continue to be inspired by the women I met there.
Women should be a priority, respected and upheld in society, given all the proper notoriety, never used or abused by authority figures. Like the media that trashes us, play down the hype that constantly bashes our image. TV movies and the videos use women's bodies to create a sick sideshow. Too many times seen as a sex symbol. No real intelligence, just a brainless bimbo. Not taken seriously for who she needs to be. A human being with the right to be free. Not misinterpreted so much of the time. A no means yes, only in a man's mind. Women who struggle and shout, take back the night, are often viewed by others in the wrong light. The daily violence of rape, don't misconstrue. It is a fact of life, and it could happen to you. You could be walking down the street, a gang of miscreants you happen to meet, high on drugs or whatever the case, they pull a knife, a hole of guns in your face. You cry, yo, can't you see I'm a man? But they just laugh and get down with their funky scams. You left to wonder, can I still call myself a man? Maybe the plight of women you can now understand. and check our history. Correctly line and define our identity.
No more distortion,
here but in a true proportion. Erase the guise of lies that had you dissing me. Check for our past and what we gave humanity.
Life from the womb of creation was born the earth, the mother of all habitations. And from her loins the beginning population. Some call her Eve, others call her Lucy.
Some try to blame her for the problems of society.
But since we know that it was men who wrote the books, perhaps we need to re-examine.
Take another look, look into Africa,
the black land they call Al-Kabla. Here is a story,
the teachings of our former glory,
of queens and warriors,
women strong and brave, refused to be subdued or taught how to behave.
They clearly understood the power within comes from God,
and should not be dictated by men.
Some ruled their nation seated on a throne, some led in battle fighting to protect their home. Some studied nature,
science is appealing,
religion and the arts reflect their deepest feeling.
Music, the list is practically endless, the contributions we have made are quite timeless. In almost every category you will find us
singing or playing instruments. Upon the world we make our mark,
we make a serious dent.
We have influence of sound, we offer soul that nowhere else can be found.
Touching of feelings that are rich and profound.
Words, let's talk about some writers who use the pen and pages, weapons of a fighter. Educating to them poetry and prose,
their essays
and the novels
and the stories
that drove a message with a rhythmical spear into our conscious minds to make us adhere to life
and its reality. Uncovering the clouds of mystery, creating hope of fulfilling our destiny. Check out the world, check out your nation. No respect for women is a no-win situation. We got to raise it to an up-iration. Keep your love for women on an Irie meditation.
Cause women are the teachers and the healers of the land. Y'all know what I'm saying, so come on and take a stand. To love and protect
all the women in your life.
Your mother and your sister and your daughter and your wife.
Your great-grandmother,
significant other.
And even all the women you don't know from one another. And the world's gonna be a whole better place. But so much more important, we may save the race.
So
women should be a priority,
women
respected and upheld in society, given all the proper notoriety, never used or abused by authority. Women should be a priority, 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 women.
Everybody needs someone to show them what is possible. Everybody needs someone to go as far as she can see. I need to stand upon the shoulders of giants. I need a woman who's as big as me. When I was a little bitty baby sitting on my mama's knee, I looked around to see just what the future had in store for me. I needed to see women who were living without limits. I needed to see women making history. So I said, give me a woman who can climb the tallest mountain. Give me a woman who can swim across the widest sea. Women need women who lead lives of boldest daring. Tell me their stories, they inspire me. Give me Amelia, who went soaring across the ocean. Winnie Mandela, who is gonna set her people free. Judy Chicago, who breaks all artistic silences. These women leave a precious legacy. When I was a young teenager, reading my 17, I looked around to see just what the future had in store for me. Women in the fashion mags were too small for my dream. I needed to see women just as big as me. So I said, give me a woman who can climb the tallest mountain. Give me a woman who can swim across the widest sea. Women need women who lead lives of boldest daring. Tell me their stories, they inspire me. I know of women all across the nation, leading lives of courage in the face of fear and poverty. One lives in an abusive home, one raises her 5 children. Women, we need a new mythology. Now that I'm a grown-up woman living in society, I still look around to see just what the future holds for me. I still need women who are shooting like the comets, so I can leave my own starlight in this galaxy. And I say, give me a woman who can climb the tallest mountain. Give me a woman who can swim across the widest sea. Women need women who lead lives bold and daring. Tell me their stories, they inspire me. Won't you please tell me their stories, they inspire me. I'd like to tell you their stories, they inspire me. Won't you please tell me their stories, they inspire me. Won't you please tell me your story, you inspire me. I'd like to tell you their stories, they inspire me. Won't you please tell me those stories, they inspire me. I'd like to hear your story, you inspire me. Won't you please tell me their stories, they inspire me.
That was Sweet Honey in the Rock with A Priority, followed by Libby Roderick with Inspire Me. Let's hear one more song today, See the Woman by John Trudell.
The woman. She has a young face, an old face. She carries herself well in all ages. She survives all man has done. In some tribes, she is free. In some religions, she is under man. In some societies, she's worth what she consumes. In some nations, she is delicate strength. In some states, she is told she is weak. In some classes, she is property owned. In all instances, she is sister to earth. In all conditions, she is life bringer. In all life, she is our necessity. See the woman eyes, flowers swaying on scattered hills, sun dancing, calling in the bees. See the woman heart, lavender butterflies, fronting blue sky, misty rain falling on soft wild roses. See the woman beauty, lightning streaking dark summer nights, forest of pines mating with new winter snow. See the woman's spirit, daily serving courage with laughter, her breath a dream and a prayer.
The Making Waves crew is Amy Antonucci, Steve Diamond, Brian Gregg, Tom Jackson, Stanley Longstaff, Dino Pappas, Joanne Paradise, and Jeff White. We welcome and need your participation, too. Contact us at nhmakingwaves@yahoo.com to volunteer or to let us know what you think of our show. We'd love your feedback. To hear previous shows, please visit our archive at www.nhindymedia.org. Many thanks to the New Hampshire Indie Media Center for hosting the archive there. If you or others you know aren't in range of the station on Saturdays, you can go to www.wirenh.com, where The Wire has been generous enough to create space for WSCA to stream audio live. Tune in with us next Saturday from 2 to 4 for our next Making Waves program here on WSCA 106.1 FM. We'll be dedicating our show to exploring Iraq and occupation in honor of the anniversary of the U.S.'s invasion of Iraq 2 years ago. We leave you with this quote. Cautious, careful people, always casting about to preserve their reputation or social standards, never can bring about reform. Those who are really in earnest are willing to be anything or nothing in the world's estimation, and publicly and privately, in season and out, avow their sympathies with despised ideas and their advocates, and bear the consequences. Susan B. Anthony.